Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I am here today with the co-founder of the Raven Foundation, Suzanne Ross. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Adam. How's it going?
I'm doing great. You beat me to the how's it going. Nicely done.
Awesome. I'll beat you to the happy Ramadan, too.
Oh, happy Ramadan. Today is the first day of Ramadan, so Ramadan Kareem, which means blessed Ramadan. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, his name means blessing, apparently. How about that?
Wow, that's gorgeous.
That's not bad, is it? Yeah.
No.
So today is Ramadan, and Suzanne and I are going to be talking about Ramadan and Islam and mimetic theory, because we talk about mimetic theory here at the Raven Foundation. And what else? And violence and nonviolence and what René Girard said about Islam. So we're going to do that. But before we do that, I just want to do some very brief minor housekeeping things. Next week, Suzanne and I are going to be at the Theology and Peace Conference in Nashville, Tennessee. Can't wait.
It's going to be great.
I know, right? It's been a couple of years since I've been to Theology and Peace Conference, and it's always a lot of fun and insightful and a lot of theology and a lot of peace building going on there. So I am looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. And I've never been to Nashville. So here we go.
Oh, well, I've never been to Nashville either. So that's going to be awesome. So, yeah, I hear there are good things to do in Nashville.
Yeah, I actually have a list.
You do.
Which I don't think we'll get to any of them because we're going to be at the conference. But just in case, there's a free moment.
That's awesome. Yeah. So we're looking forward to that. And maybe we'll do some live broadcasts from the Theology and Peace Conference.
Well,
I stay up to date on the Raven Foundation Facebook page for possible live reflections on theology and peace. Why not?
Sounds great.
Sounds good. Also next week. So that's Monday through Thursday we'll be there. On Friday, it looks like I am going to be interviewing Rachel Keefe, who has written a book called The Life-Saving Church, Faith Communities, and Suicide Prevention. So that's a huge and important topic that I'll be discussing with her. So, yeah. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm getting the book tomorrow and I'm going to read it. And we're going to talk about suicide prevention in the church. So that'll be Friday, next Friday at, we haven't gotten a time yet. So stay up to date on the Raven Foundation Facebook page for that.
Great.
Yeah. Awesome. So I think that's, the other thing, Suzanne, that I wanted to mention is that I got this really great book from our friend, Jim Papandrea.
Yeah.
Called From Star Wars to Superman, Christ Figures in Science Fiction and Superhero Films.
I am so glad you got it.
I'm nerding out right now about this book. Yeah. I just cannot wait. Theology and Star Wars and Superman. It's awesome. So I'm going to read the book, and I haven't talked to Jim about this yet, but I'd love to interview him.
Yeah. My gosh. He would have a great time talking with you about it.
Yes. So that'll be awesome. But today we're talking about Ramadan and mimetic theory and nonviolence.
Yes. And Adam, we are going to be specifically focusing on an essay that you have in this wonderful book, Mimetic Theory and World Religions, edited by our friends Wolfgang Palaver and Richard Schenk. And you have, there's a section of the book devoted to Islam, and you have one of the essays in there that's titled Tawhid. Is that how you say it?
Tawhid? Yes. Go with it.
Yeah, Tawhid, the oneness of God and the desire for the good. And it's a fabulous essay, and it's a great way for us to talk about what mimetic theory has to say about Ramadan. But before we get into that, let's just talk about what is Ramadan, like what's going on.
Ramadan is all about, the history of Ramadan goes back to Muhammad. Mary Gay McKinney says hi. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi, Mary.
So the history of Ramadan goes all the way back to Muhammad, and even for in the Islamic tradition, it goes actually before Muhammad. So Ramadan is the month, is a month in the Islamic calendar, and it's the month where Muslims believe that the Quran was delivered to Muhammad. So there's a tradition that says that the Quran only came, like, over his 40-year ministry, the passages of the Quran, the chapters of the Quran, came to him during the months, during the month of Ramadan. So when Muhammad earlier in his career climbed up a mountain for a spiritual retreat, that's when the angel Gabriel came to him during the near the end of the month of Ramadan and gave him the first the first scripture of the Quran. So Muslims also believe, tend to believe, that all of scripture, so the Hebrew Bible and Christian scriptures, were also delivered during the month of Ramadan. So so the month of Ramadan is this holy month because it's the month where God comes with the holy scriptures. So God is always present with us, but this is where the holy scriptures are revealed to Muhammad and to Christians and Jews.
Yeah, it was a really deeply mystical experience that Muhammad was experiencing. It was an answer to prayer in a lot of ways. Wasn't he praying for some revelation from God about what does it mean to worship you?
Yes, right. Yes. So what the age that Muhammad was born into was called, is called the Jahiliya for Muslims, and it means the age of ignorance. And so people were ignorant about what God was really up to in the world. And this is often viewed as polytheism, but it's really, the technical term is really henotheism. So there's this high God in pre-Islamic Arabia who is called Allah. So it's the same word that Muhammad ends up using for God. And it just means the God, right? So in pre-Islamic Arabia, there's the high God who doesn't really care about what's happening on earth. Very, what's the word? Indifferent to the matters that's going on earth. And between God and earth are all of these different divinities. And they, like, people would pray to these divinities in order for these divinities. They were intermediaries. So the divinities would go up to God and maybe get God to care, maybe not. Things like this. So Muhammad is born into this world, and what it does is it basically affirms the status quo. So there's this, one of the gods is time, and time is the god who sets things up. So things are the way they are because the divine has set it up that way. Time has set it up that way. And there's nothing really that you can do about it. So if you're poor, if you're suffering, it's, there's nothing you can do about it. It's just the way that things are. So Muhammad is born into this world, and he sees that it's not right. There's something wrong with the way that the world is. And there's something wrong with this theology behind it. So Muhammad starts delivering this message that God is not somewhere aloof way out there. Allah is not way out there somewhere out there, but Allah is here. The God is here and cares about suffering and the poor, and leads those of us who have means, who are more well off, to care for those who are not. This is the message of justice that Islam brings into the world. And it relates to Ramadan, because the month of Ramadan is a month of fasting in order to get closer to God, in order to get closer to the God who cares about the poor and the weak and the marginalized and the vulnerable. So, and if you're close to that God, then you're going to also care about the poor of the weak and the vulnerable.
Right. Yeah. Right? I mean, the fast is pretty intense though, isn't it? I mean, it's sunrise to sundown, right? And so when Ramadan, the month of Ramadan falls during the summer here in the Northern Hemisphere, the fasting time is longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's abstaining from food, drink, even water, and sexual activity, right, during the day. So, it's very interesting from a medic point of view about fasting, because it does have to do, we could say, in a way of reorienting your desires, right, to more closely align with God, because fasting is part of many spiritual traditions. And I think it connects to that, wouldn't you say? This
right, yes. It's really, Deborah Holden says she's here.
So, oh, great.
Hi, Deborah. Good to see you. It's really like we can emphasize what mimetic theory does for me is helps me to see the human side of it. You know, the big mm-hmm. academic word is the anthropological side of it. So yeah, it's a way of getting closer to God. But it's also a way of empathizing with our fellow human beings. Mm-hmm. So when you are going through fasting, it's not just, oh, so that I can get closer to God. It's also so that I can get closer to experiencing what it's like to be vulnerable, to be those, to be one with those who are on the margins, and not just to be one with them and share in their suffering, but also to try to alleviate it as best I can. This is one of the things that I love about Islam is, and some people will disagree with that this is a great thing, but there's this, there's the offering, which is often called a tax. Right. But you might just as well view it as an offering that you give, a religious offering to the poor. So you give a certain amount of your income to help alleviate the poor. And it's it's not just a religious tax. It's also a state tax. So it's in Islam. Yeah, it's true in Islam. And also in most religions, like the secular and the profane are not as separate as we moderns want to make it out to be. Like the impulse in order to care for the poor is a sacred and political obligation. The two meet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this political dimension of we're going to take care of the poor because that's what God wants us to do.
Right. And that isn't that how Ramadan ends, with a feast in which everyone is invited and in which food is distributed to the poor and the hungry.
And a lot of Muslims will do that throughout Ramadan. So not just at the end, but like nights when they break the fast, I'll bring in everybody from the community and they'll have this food that they share with one another. So
yeah, when I read about Muslims observing Ramadan, you know, you can focus on the fasting and it can feel like really like a hardship, but mostly they're talking about the party at the end of each day. It's like, it's this big party every night. It's kind of cool.
It's such a good point, Suzanne, because I think that a lot of times in religion, you can see it as something like an obligation. Like it's something that's like, it's on the monkey on your back and you have to do this. And you can even get this in some misunderstandings of Islam where Allah is seen as this like most powerful figure and you have to just bow down to Allah in order to get Allah on your side and things. But that's not it. It's like when Muslims do this, they do it with a sense of, well, not all of them, but you know, I mean, the vast majority, it's supposed to have a sense of joy.
Yeah.
Go along with it. Like, yes, there's this suffering and you're these impulses that you try to, you know, move through, right? It is a discipline, but God is with you in the discipline and you're with one another in the discipline, and through the discipline you can see that you're making it through difficult times together. Exactly. And there's a certain joy that you get out of being in a community and going through these experiences together.
Exactly right. And we have a comment from Cheryl Zimmerman, who's reminding us, of course, that the obligation to fast is only for those who have the strength and the health to do it. If it's going to harm your health, the obligation to fast is lifted for you. So
right.
It's not this imposed requirement.
Right.
Only for those who are able. Like we say in church, please stand. Those who are able, please stand.
Yes. You know,
it's like that. Well, what I'd like us to do is move into some of the ways in which mimetic theory has dealt with Islam. And it's been a little bit controversial. Mimetic theory has sort of come late to engaging with Islam and in terms of the history of mimetic theory. And Wolfgang Palaver from Innsbruck has been one of the prime voices leading that engagement with Islam, and he's done incredible work in that regard. But the founder of mimetic theory, René Girard, has said some controversial things, and I wanted to ask you about these comments of his, Adam, because you write about them in your essay. And I mean, so far, the way we've been talking about Allah, it sounds like, you know, a good guy. Allah doesn't sound like a violent deity. And yet, after 9/11, Girard wrote that we are witnessing an escalation to extremes. That the attacks were a clear sign of a return to the sacred. And he said, personally, I have the impression that Islam has used the Bible as a support to rebuild an archaic religion. And, you know, those of us who work in mimetic theory know this idea of archaic religion is very central to Girard's theory. And we are kind of, our antenna are always up spotting it. So I'm wondering before we talk about, is Islam an archaic religion? What does Girard mean by that term, by archaic religion?
Well, the statement that Islam could be returned to the archaic is a pretty damning statement towards Islam. And what the archaic is, so for mimetic theory, violence is not a problem just for religion, whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or atheist. It's a human problem, right? Mm-hmm. So what Girard says is that from the very beginning of human culture, culture was formed out of a sacrificial act. So before you have culture, humans were often in conflicts with one another. And it was this war of all against all. And so a lot of these early human groups, they're not communities yet or cultures yet. A lot of these early human groups, they explode from a war of all against all. And what Girard ends up postulating is that the war of all against all gets turned into a war of all against one. So all of this inner hostility that we have against one another gets channeled onto a scapegoat. And we see this happening throughout human history, right? It still happens today. What's the easiest way to build solidarity with someone? Unite against a common enemy. That's kind of the human default way of doing it.
It's kind of the mechanism behind gossip.
Yes, it's absolutely, absolutely. So what's happening, Girard postulates, is not something that is out of the blue. It's something that you see happening all the time. So this massive, as you say, gossiping on a communal level. And so people are accusing one another, pointing the finger against one another, and then all of a sudden, all of the accusations gets pointed against one individual figure. So all of the hostilities are channeled against that one person. That person is probably sacrificed, maybe expelled, but probably sacrificed. And after the sacrificial act, there's peace. There's a temporary sense of peace among the community, enough that over time, culture is able to form from these sacrificial acts. So, and again, we see this temporary sense of peace whenever we unite against a common enemy. So the archaic sacred is this idea that Girard puts forth that over time, a religion is born as this pattern continues to develop of an archaic religion begins to develop, and a theology begins to develop where the gods have conflicting wills, you might say. So there's this there's, in order to get peace, we have to use sacrificial violence against a common enemy. The gods demand that we use this sacrifice against an enemy in order to create peace. And then what ends up happening is this temporary peace is seen as a gift from the gods, right? So the gods have this conflicting violence and peace within it. And so that's how the theology emerges of the conflicting wills within God.
Yeah.
So the gods have a
dual nature. They're both the cause of the violence and the cure, the peace. So hence the need to always pacify the gods and make sure you're on the good side, because they, it could erupt on your, you know, against you. The force of the gods could be against you, or that could be for you. You just never quite know, right?
Right. Yes. You never know what, if the gods are for you or against you. That's exactly it. So to say that Islam is a return to the archaic is to say that the theology in Islam has a God who has these conflicting wills. And the way that I manage this is the fundamental theological principle of Islam is called Tawhid. I think you mentioned it earlier. Mm-hmm. And Tawhid refers to the oneness within God. And Michael Sells is an Islamic scholar. And Michael Sells says that the Tawhid of God means that there can be no conflicting wills, no conflicting desires within God. God is essentially one, mm-hmm. right? And so this, I think, is a critique of the archaic sacred. God, the Tawhid of God, the oneness of God, means that God's will, God's desires, everything about God is directed in one direction. And the question is, which direction is that? There are 114 chapters of the Quran. 113 of them begin with the what's called the Bismillah. And the Bismillah, it says this, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. So the oneness of God, I think this is the lens that the Quran is giving us mm-hmm. to interpret God, mm-hmm. is compassion and mercy. And it's not just compassion and mercy for us and not for them. The Quran states over and over again that God created all of humanity, not that we might fight with one another, but that we might know one another, you know? Yeah. So this leads to, you know, how do you interpret the violent aspects, the violence within the Quran? And, you know, that's a really good and important question. And I think it's also important to ask that with some humility, because every sacred text, the Bible, has violence within it. The question is not whether or not there's violence within a sacred text. The question is whether there's the text, the sacred text, provides a way to interpret that violence.
Yes, absolutely. Right?
So that's how we in mimetic theory are able to deal with the Bible. Gerard calls it a text in travail. So you get both of these views, violent God and a nonviolent God within it. Mm-hmm. And what's the thrust? Where is it going? Does it have the interpretive principles for us in there to interpret in a more peaceful, nonviolent way of God? And I think that the Quran does that at the beginning of each chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very ironic that Christians love to ask Muslims how do you interpret the violence in not just in your text, but in your history? When we need to be asking ourselves the same questions. And you're absolutely right to point that out. And I think I want to bring up two comments. Britt Johnston points out that the Hajj, the pilgrimage rituals around the pilgrimage to Mecca include an animal sacrifice. I think it's a reenactment of the non-sacrifice of Isaac, isn't it?
Yeah, only in Islam it would be the non-sacrifice of Ishmael.
Of Ishmael, there right. you go.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. How do you interpret that fact that animal sacrifice is part of such an important observance in Islam?
It's a good question, and I have to look more into it. I would say that it's part of the movement away from human sacrifice.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a good enough answer for this question, especially for mimetic theorists. But I think there's also the stoning of the animal, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure what to make of that. Whenever people bring up animal sacrifice, it's a good question, and I also worry about the way that we treat animals that we kill and eat and stuff. Yeah. So they're not yeah. treated really well right. here in the West. So, sure. but it's a great question, Britt, and I would have to look more into it.
Yeah, and Steve McKenna, who's hosting the Cover Conference this year in Denver, says, that's a good question for Jack Miles, who is presenting at the Cover Conference, and he has a new book coming out in the fall called God in the Quran. And it is an analysis of, who does the Quran say God is? Mm-hmm. And so we could ask him about that sacrifice. And
you
Mary...
know, I would say one other thing about that. There's the Quran presents before us two models for really how to be in the world. One is Allah, and the other is the Satan, which is really interesting because we know of the Satan as the accuser. And there's this passage in the Quran where the Satan says, I will incite them to be against one another, to accuse one another. This is what's the founding principle at the beginning of human culture is where we're accusing one another. It's satanic. The Quran, that's what the Quran calls. There's also this really interesting passage as the Satan is saying this, where the Satan says, I will incite them to cut the throat of camels and animals. There's something about Satan and even animal sacrifice that's there within the text. That says that maybe this isn't what God wants. And I think that might be worth exploring too. I have that passage in my paper, by the way.
Yeah, you do. So, yeah. I know. Did we mention it's a great chapter in this great book?
Yeah. So,
it's fabulous. Mimetic Theory and World Religions. Now, Mary McKinney wants to know what you think of Karen Armstrong's book on Islam. Have you read that? I've read it a long time ago.
Yeah, it's. I like the question. It's. I read Karen Armstrong's book on Islam, and I've also read her book on Muhammad. And her book on Muhammad, it's the biography, is what really got me interested in Islam. I had to read it for my one of my classes in college, and I remember reading it, and it was in 2002. So 9/11 had just happened, and I was like, what is it about Islam that led people to do this? Mm. Or what is it about people who are Muslims that led them to do this? And is this really Islam, or is it something else going on here? And I remember reading her book and just being totally inspired by it to continue researching Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a beautiful book. I don't like everything that Karen Armstrong writes, but I would recommend that book on Muhammad to anyone.
Yeah. Mary pulls a quote out that Islam has been hijacked by the men.
hasn't everything been hijacked by the men?
It's very interesting. I don't know what Armstrong meant by that exactly. Yeah. We all bring our stereotypes to our gender roles, which is something we probably should avoid trafficking in. But I think that Islam, like all, I think, in attempts to undo the sacrificial mechanism, they get hijacked by it. You know, it's all good can be turned and in turned against itself, which is very frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, for the,
it can be easy for me to start to emphasize, one of the questions that we have to deal with in this is Muhammad's violence. Yeah. The whole time that Muhammad was in Mecca, the first 12 or 14 years of his ministry, the people that he had to go up against were his own tribe. It was the power tribe called the Quraysh. And he was born into the Quraysh, into this power tribe. And he saw that it was his own people, his own tribe, that was holding up the status quo and not caring for those who are on the margins. He knew that they were being scapegoated, and he knew that God was calling him to do something about it. Mm. Right. And so he goes up and he challenges his own tribe, and his tribe turns against him. They're invested in the status quo. And so they don't want to believe in this new theology that says that God actually cares about those on the margins. Mm-hmm. So they end up trying to kill Muhammad. And for the first 12, 14 years of his ministry, Muhammad responds with nonviolence. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of Muslims, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, a bunch of other ones that I quote in the article, will say that this is the moment at the beginning of his ministry where we need to follow Muhammad today. We need to follow Muhammad when he was nonviolent in Mecca. And they have different reasons for this. One of them is because, as we Girardians know, violence is escalated out of control and we can now destroy the world. And God certainly doesn't want us to destroy the world. And so we need to find nonviolent, peaceful ways of dealing with our conflicts, like Muhammad tried to do in the first 12 years of his ministry. Now, after that, he moves to Medina, and this is often called the more violent phase of Muhammad's life. And so this in Medina, you get some passages in the Quran where God says, go and, you know, kill them wherever you find them. But if they call for peace, then you must give peace, right? So these are the difficult passages that we have to also deal with in Muhammad's life and in the Quran. And you know, I think one of the things that Girard has taught me is that you can't attribute violence to God, because violence belongs to humans. Yes. God is the merciful one, the compassionate one, as the Quran says. But Girard also was not a pacifist. Mm-hmm. Right? So
No, he wasn't. It's misunderstood, but yeah.
Right? So yeah. We are going to, when you're not a pacifist, you say that there are situations where you can be, where you can use violence. It's a failure on many levels, maybe, but there are justifications for it.
Yeah. Well, and I think also it's the mimetic understanding that violence is, a relationship and it's reciprocal, and paradoxically you can call out a violent response by, adopting a position of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. So that can be a threat, that can be seen as either a threat to the position of the violent one, or makes you a target, an easy target for the expression of the violence that's coming. So I think, you know, Girard is not saying that he prefers to be violent when he says, I'm a pacifist. What he's saying is, I'm really aware of how easy it is to trigger violent outbursts, and being completely adopting this purity position of total nonviolence can draw it out. Mm-hmm. So it's a very mimetic understanding of violence that I think, you know, makes him misunderstood. Right. Yeah. Right. But anyway, can Cheryl, you see this comment from Cheryl?
Yes. Yeah. Cheryl says, back in my small town, Indiana Methodist church, right after 9/11, a young minister said this: to compare all Muslims to Islamic terrorists is the same as saying that Christian, oh,
that Christianity is represented by Jim Jones, or the leader of Heaven's Gate.
Right.
It was a striking statement in 2001. I mean, it's the same. I mean, nowadays, the very ultra right wing Orthodox Christian theology that's sort of driving this move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem is not shared by all Christians. We are not all trying to bring about the apocalypse by forcing the historical situation to change here. But it is very, I think, those of us who cast stones from the Christian perspective at these sort of radical interpretations of Islam need to check our own house and get it in order.
Yes, there is that. Mary has this comment that I think is good to talk about. She was traveling in Florida on a beach in the summer of 2015, and a Muslim woman, mother in full black burqa with a tiny slit for her eyes, staying inside the hotel because of the heat. The father was on the beach in shorts and t-shirts, as were the sons. Daughters approximately 6 and 13 covered in black ankle to neck. I wouldn't have a problem if the men covered themselves in the same way. They have flexibility in how they dress. Women and girls, not so much. That might be an example of hijacking. And I think it is. And a lot of Muslims Muslim men don't force women to dress like that. In fact, in the Quran, it says, and I'm conflicted about this too, but it says that only Muhammad's wives were supposed to dress like that in public. Mm. And it was in part, the justification for it was in part to stop mimetic envy or rivalry for his wives. So, but it was only stipulated for Muhammad's wives. It's not for every Muslim woman. Mm-hmm. So if a Muslim woman wants to do that, I'm sure that's fine for whatever reason. But, you know, it's also, Muslim women, some Muslim women dress this way, and some Western women do the exact opposite, right? And show like almost everything on the beach. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe there's a happy meeting.
Which is more abusive to women? I don't know. Those cultural standards, I think a lot of practices that get associated with Islam are really more cultural practices. Like the Muslims here in the U.S. that I know and that I've attended workshops with and conferences, none of the women are clothed that way. So it's very cultural specific. And there again, within Christianity, there's a lot of what might be interpreted as male dominance over women. Women must submit to male authority and so forth. And those are things that many of us critique about our own as an interpretation of our faith. We don't agree with that, and we think it's very legitimate to critique it. And I think that's happening in Islam as well. So I think there's more alike than separates us, I think, between these two great world religions right now. So it's always sad to see any rhetoric that incites hate against Islam, or, you know, that comes out of our government that says, you know, Muslims hate us and Islam's out to get us and so forth. This is just very sad, depressing. And during Ramadan, especially those of us who have Muslim friends, I think it's very important to reach out to them and support, encouragement, and say, we're with you, you know, let us know if you're experiencing any problems. Because, you know, I've heard many stories of Christians going like to a mosque and standing there to show solidarity when a mosque is being threatened, or when there's, any risk that the Muslims are facing. So I think if we can be companions to our Muslim friends during Ramadan. And a little fasting probably wouldn't hurt us either.
Yeah. I'm feeling a little hungry right now. I should not have said that on the first day of Ramadan. I'm really sorry. That was totally insensitive of me. I'm sorry. Okay. But it reminds me, your comment says, you reminds me of this passage in the Quran where it says about these people of different faiths, vie with one another, compete with one another in doing good. You know, so if there's any competition among you, be it for the competition of doing good in the world.
Perfect.
Yeah, I like that. Right. So thank you, everybody, for your wonderful questions.
Fantastic.
A lot of fun having this conversation with all of you. And did we miss any? No. Muhammad Islam Awan, my Facebook friend, says thanks. Thank you, Muhammad.
Thanks. Yeah.
Just a reminder that next week we'll be having some live videos on the Raven Foundation page live from Theology and Peace. So that'll be a lot of fun. So stay up to date there. And also next Friday, I will be talking with Rachel Keefe, the author of the book, The Life-Saving Church, Faith, Communities, and Suicide Prevention. So that'll be an important conversation next Friday. So stay up to date with all things Raven Cast at the Raven Foundation Facebook page and at the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. So until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.